Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. And I want to remind the audience that we Zoom our show. We do it the day before, so we're actually putting this together on Mother's Day. So I'm going to apologize to my guests because I'm pulling you away from family, perhaps. But that's what we do. Anyway, we begin our show every day with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman when he was testifying in the fall of 2019 during the impeachment hearing. And as I was getting ready for the show, I thought, what do I really know about Colonel Vindman? I know he wasn't born here. I know he thanks his father for bringing him here. And I know he has at least one brother, and it turns out he has two brothers, and one of them is a twin. So as I was doing a little bit of work, I thought I would share this nugget with you that I actually also posted on Facebook for Mother's Day. And I wrote this: my Mother's Day story, dedicated to a mother that never saw the gifts she gave the world. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, the National Security Council official who twice raised concerns about the Trump administration pressuring Ukraine into investigations against political rivals, was featured in Ken Burns' America series in the 1980s, the series called The Statue of Liberty. Alexander Vindman and his twin brother told Burns' camera crew when they were a mere 10 years old that they were from Russia, while the other said, "No, we're from Kiev. Our mother died, so we went to Italy," one said. And then the other said, "And then we came here." Ken Burns reminds us, theirs is the story of America at its best. All right, everyone, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Let me welcome to the program on this Mother's Day pre-tape for Monday, our Rethink the Week guests. We actually had three folks booked, but one of them got scolded by his wife, and that was Glenn Smith, who would join us normally from Texas. But I want to remind everyone that Texas is an hour earlier, so if we were taping the show at 4, it would be 3 o'clock Glenn's time, and that was in the middle of a Zoom family event, and we could not interrupt that. But our two guests, however, were willing to sort of share their Mother's Day with us. Joining us from UNH Manchester and the Carsey Institute is Stephen Pimper. Let me welcome Stephen to the program. How are you, Stephen?
Hey, Arnie. Nice to see you.
It's a pleasure to see you. And also joining us is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar and teaches at Southern New Hampshire University. He also is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio, where you hear him, where he does his sort of version of Rethink the Week. So much to talk about, you guys. And I saw something really interesting that I wanted to, again, read out loud to you. The New Republic magazine is starting something that they were going to put out every Sunday that sort of talks about sort of the horrific choices that folks are being asked to make as a result of this COVID-19 situation and the drive to go back to work. And I'm not going to read all of it, but I do want to read a portion of it, in part because you know that one of the places where those choices are having sort of very negative consequences is who is definitely working, but the guys that work at Amazon, okay? Since no one's shopping, everyone is now doing everything online, and it is, they're hiring up, but are they protecting their workers? And what we're finding out is they're really not, and it's incredibly difficult to protect their workers. And it got so bad that an Amazon vice president Tim Bray, decided to quit. And what he said was that he was concerned with the possibility that there is a source of moral authority in his universe, and rather than, since there is no source, that he needed to resign rather than to watch the despicable company policies that were worsening the lives of workers lowest on Amazon's organizational chart. Bray cited the firings of two employees who criticized the company's warehouse operations and climate policies included the termination of one Amazon worker who attempted to lead a strike to force the corporation to provide safer workplaces during the coronavirus crisis. These, Bray wrote in a blog post, were evidence of a vein of toxicity running through the company culture. And what the deputy editor from New Republic is decided to do is to put out a series every Sunday entitled The Vein of Toxicity, right? And what he said was that throughout the United States, the perverse push to reopen America is slowly taking hold, even as the early returns show a spike in COVID-19 cases and deaths. With so much at risk, and the best way of avoiding the coronavirus continuing to remain is by continuing to remain in quarantine. Unfortunately, that is not being addressed. Now, this is the part that I'm not surprised by, but I wanted to address on our Rethink the Week to open the show. In the state of Ohio, many workers don't have the options of staying at home because of the fear of contracting COVID. They're being forced to work. The government there, listen to this, is asking employers to report any workers who refuse available work on the grounds that they are worried about contracting COVID-19. These workers will be deemed ineligible for unemployment benefits. The state has even gone to the trouble and expense of setting up an online portal so that bosses can narc on those who don't want to die. According to the Washington Post, some 600 employers have already turned in 1,200 people who refuse to put their lives at risk. It is very likely that the next wave of coronavirus deaths will feature those in this cohort of ratted out workers. Our shared experience from the catastrophic unemployment that followed the 2008 financial crash informs us that spikes in suicide are also a likely outcome. Hopefully, those tasked with processing those benefit claims aren't working in an enclosed environment. And hopefully, those who might soon be drafted into duty as cannon fodder for the free market's fusillade against an invisible microbe might be properly eulogized. Because while it may be that these workers are contracting COVID-19, what is killing them is a toxic vein of capitalism. I get to shelter in place. I'm a gig worker because I have an Airbnb in my house, and that turns out to be my income, because as many of you know, this is a volunteer job that I do on The Attitude, so I don't get compensated for this, although I love it and work very hard at it, but it doesn't actually generate revenue, and therefore my Airbnb generates revenue and actually pays things like my taxes. Not only do I get to shelter in place, but I get to apply for unemployment as a gig worker, because the governor has shut down all short-term rentals and Airbnbs. And even though I didn't want anyone in my house anyway, and would have done it because of concern of contracting COVID-19, because this is about an Airbnb in my house, it's a bedroom in my house, I don't want strangers coming into my house because I don't want anyone to get ill. But at the same time, the governor has also mandated that it's shut down. So last Monday, I got to apply for unemployment. How lucky am I, Dean Spiliotis? No one's going to rat me out. I get to stay at home. I may, assuming they, you know, permit me to collect the unemployment, I've not been approved yet, but not only will I collect a small portion of what would normally be an unemployment check, but I get that additional $600. Look what is happening to people who, like me, are concerned about COVID-19, are concerned about the fact that we may have an underlying condition, or we may be old, or we may be worried about lots of other things. I get the luxury of protecting my health and safety. And these folks, not just in Ohio, but in other states, are getting ratted out. What does that say about us?
Well, you know, we've talked about this, I think, throughout the crisis so far, and it really is kind of further laid bare the inequities driven by, you know, socioeconomic class, racial disparities, et cetera. I've mentioned a couple times on the show some data I saw last month that said that, you know, I think 1 in 5 African American individuals can work from home, and only 1 in 6 Latinos right. can work from home.
Right.
For the beginning of the pandemic, we were primarily focused on, you know, essential workers in this category being, you know, grocery store, first responders, mass transit, and then some mail order like Amazon. But as the country starts to open back up and manufacturing starts back up, the problem is only going to get worse. And part of the issue is that it's really happening on a state-by-state basis. There are some states in which if you don't feel safe going back to work immediately, you can continue to claim unemployment. But there are other states where you can't do that. If you turn down the opportunity to go back to work, you sacrifice your benefit. So there are all kinds of issues around how we address this. I think, you know, I've seen a lot of writing and commentary that this is a problem, but have not heard much yet about potential solutions and or the likelihood that states and particularly the federal government are going to make enforcing the appropriate procedures to help improve safety. Any kind of enforcement mechanism to make sure that these new, when manufacturing firms start back up, when food processing plants reopen, that they are following whatever the guidelines are. But there's no doubt there's no doubt that this Correct. Is a very problematic issue for states and the federal government, and it's only going to get worse. You know, we've seen it throughout the last month and a half, and as the economy opens back up, it's going to be an even bigger issue.
Well, let me just say something. And so, Stephen, as I'm thinking about this, I just want people to put these two stories together. What they're doing in Ohio by literally, you know, forcing these people to work, to basically narc on them, you know, to sort of like pinpoint them to make sure that they never get unemployment. But then you have the situation going on right now in Trump's freaking White House, where what we have is Stephen Miller's wife, by the way, who happens to be the press secretary for the vice president, now is COVID-19 positive. Ivanka Trump's top aide is COVID-19 positive. The person who serves the meals to Donald Trump, the hamburgers and the chocolate cake, is COVID-19 positive. So when you look at a setting where they're neurotic, about protecting the vice president and the president. That means they're cleaning all the time. People are getting tested all the time. People are getting their temperatures taken all the time. If they get COVID-19, imagine how susceptible people are who are working in settings where there isn't 1/22nd of that kind of concern about safety, about concern about testing, about wiping things down. In a lot of ways, I want the same protections that are being given the Trump administration in my work setting if you're going to force me to go back to work or tell me that I can't collect unemployment because I'm afraid. I mean, those two stories need to be sort of in a split screen because it says everything about privilege and who is expendable.
And, you know, once again, brings us back to this perennial question of trying to make sense of the behavior of the Trump administration and what do we allocate to malice and what do we allocate to incompetence? And, you know, on the one hand, I think that part of what we see going on, not just in the White House and trying to push people back out to work, violating their own guidelines from the CDC, right? I mean, literally ignoring the guidelines that were touted by the administration live on television not that long ago, and the what seems to be a commitment from Mitch McConnell, majority leader in the Senate, to not distribute any more aid to people or to businesses, which again is going to push more people out into the workforce necessarily because they will have no alternatives if they want to try to pay the rent and want to try to feed themselves. If we were doing that and we had the kind of testing, tracing, and isolation regime that every public health expert on the planet has been telling us is a necessity in order to start to gather together in more confined spaces, maybe we could justify that behavior. In the absence of any of that, what that says is that there is some relatively large number of people who we are ex ante deciding we will allow to become sick and die. Now that's ugly and awful, but the thing about it that is particularly frustrating is the reasonable assumption that that is not going to be the price we pay for an economy to get moving again, right? That is going to inhibit the ability of the real economy to function because we are going to see breakouts popping out place to place, business to business. We're going to have this constant state of fear. We're not going to know who's sick. We're not going to know where it's safe to go. So people are going to continue, as they do in depressions, to hold on to their money out of fear, making things worse.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
The sort of the throwing people into the maw and letting them die in order to generate financial gain, even that ugly, cynical thing actually won't pay off because they're too dumb to recognize that that will fail.
Okay, so now let me go. So Dean, I want to do the 180 degree story. So here we are throwing people away, basically saying your life isn't worth it. You can go to work. We don't have to actually set standards. It doesn't matter. And we're going to finger you if you don't show up. So then the story came out of New York, and I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but I believe that the number of people who have been stopped for not appropriately social distancing, for not wearing masks, for not obeying whatever de Blasio's rules are or Cuomo's rules are, it turns out like 4 out of 5 of every person who's been stopped is a person of color or Hispanic, okay? So isn't this interesting? In Ohio, we don't give a crap what happens to you. And if you're going to get COVID-19, you still have to show up for work. But the only people that we notice who aren't, quote unquote, obeying the rules, as if anybody's obeying the rules, or we even understand what the rules are, it turns out that it's people of color who the cops are stopping and either citing or doing whatever for not playing by the, you know, how to appropriately respond to the coronavirus pandemic. And again, why did they notice, you know, Hispanics and Blacks who are not social distancing, when then you can take pictures of people at the park or walking down Fifth Avenue and you kind of notice, I don't think that's 6 feet. I'm not even sure that's 2 feet. And yet, look what's happening here. So once again, there is a standard, but the standard is only for white people. There is a standard, but the standard is only for wealthy people. There is a way of winking and nodding, but we only wink and nod when it's a person of privilege or a person who happens not to be a person of color. I mean, the story out of New York is really a continuation on that theme, Dean.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, there's not really, it's not particularly shocking. It's just another venue or another set of circumstances with which you can have a conversation that we've been having for years now about differential enforcement across different communities. And I saw at least one article on what you're referring to in some pictures, you know, sort of African-American predominant communities versus kind of white affluent communities. And I think in a more general level, I don't think the police are particularly happy to have to be enforcing the wearing masks and social distancing. I've read a number of complaints from various law enforcement communities around the country that they think that that's just sort of not realistic for them to do. And it's very difficult to, I think there was a one point last weekend where, you know, the police ended up writing in California, I think it was literally like thousands of warnings. And so you wonder what, you know, in addition to kind of the issue you're describing of the racial component, using scarce resources.
It used to be driving while black. Then it used to be walking while black. Now it's not social distancing while black. I just want, yes. I mean, there's
Could I just say one thing?
Yes.
Let me say one more thing before we get on to another topic. Going back to the Trump White House issue, you know, and President Trump said yesterday, the day before, that the fact that Katie Miller tested negative one day and then positive the next day shows you that testing is not, you know, universal testing is not particularly useful, but he misses the point. The fact that they were able to quickly identify that she had it allowed them to pull people off of Vice President Pence's plane, Air Force Two. It allowed them to imagine if they didn't have that daily testing regimen, either she or the president's valet could have been, you know, walking around the West Wing for a week or two asymptomatic or a week before he or she develops symptoms, think of the multiplier effect that would have had. So in fact, the kind of testing regimen they've had is the kind that you need for other companies so you can quickly identify people,
exactly.
whether it's 24 hours or 48 hours, rather than have, you know, what they call vectors, infectious yeah. individuals, you know, just in the workforce.
But it doesn't matter about getting yeah. it. He wants to manipulate any story. So even if the story exposes what the real truth is, he then gets to sort of twist the story. So once again, he's right, you're wrong. I mean, remember, he doesn't value the concept of testing, but he does because he's tested every single freaking day. So even as he tells you, you don't need a test, he gets tested virtually almost every single day, if not every day. Ken, I know you want to weigh in.
Yeah, well, let me just say to Dean's point that the fact that Katie Miller got tested 2 days in a row probably saved the vice president's life and maybe the president's as well.
Yeah, that's the point. But, he completely misunderstands the daily test. It
exactly.
actually helped them quickly identify rather than have her going around for a week or two infecting everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Arnie, what I was going to say about the racial disparity in the people arresting, I think that number could be very helpful to Black Lives Matter, who are trying to make the point that people of color are indeed fingered more often by the police and others for wrongdoing. And nobody can say, I know that a lot of racially biased people may have said, well, Black people probably commit more crimes and that's why they're stopped more. They live in neighborhoods where there are more crimes and that's where they're stopped more. But this is a perfectly innocent social distancing thing, which nobody could say that Black people are inclined to stay 2 feet apart when white people are more inclined to stay 6 people apart. That is just clearly has nothing to do with facts. And this is clearly just bias. There is no other explanation than bigotry.
I can't get away from this story because it's making me so crazy. So Stephen, let me just sort of end with this story. There is an older woman in her late 60s. She's Black. She lives in a sort of, her husband teaches at Columbia. She's a writer, very distinguished. People have actually heard her speak. She is out early in the morning in downtown Manhattan, I think sort of on the edge of Harlem, and she is going shopping for food, okay? So it's early and she's got her, you know, her jacket on, and she goes past a boarded storefront. And it's very early in the morning, and she's looking at the boarded store. She's a very distinguished woman. She opens her purse, takes out a piece of pink chalk, okay? And on the boarded storefront writes, Trump equals plague in pink chalk. Guess what happens? An SUV with four cops see her, jump out of the car, and they arrest her and drag her downtown. And of course, it takes her hours to finally get a hold of her husband and whatever. So let me tell you, I've been in similar situations, okay? Where I have done something with a piece of chalk, okay? And it's, you know, it's graffiti, but it's chalk and whatever. I've actually been stopped. And here's what's happened. The cop will stop me and say, oh, lady, you know that this isn't your property. And I'll go, yes, sir, I do. But, you know, I'm trying to make a political point. And what the cop will say to me is, you know what? Let's wipe it off together. And please don't do it again. All right? That's what happened to white Arnie. But this Black woman in Manhattan gets dragged down by the cops for writing Trump equals plague on a boarded storefront in New York, and even has, and she's there for hours before finally she gets a hold of her husband and she gets out of there. Again, it's another example of, look what we are doing. We know that we're seeing more Blacks and Hispanics dying. We know they don't have access to healthcare. We see this gross inequality between wealth and poverty. And then to see this, you would think, if nothing else, given all the information we're sort of talking about the inequality, that it would make at least some people at least be more aware. But it appears that they don't get it.
But why would you think that? I mean, the entire history of the before we were the United States of America, right? Going back to the first slave ship in 1619, through the history of slavery, through the Jim Crow era, through the period of mass incarceration, to the moment in which we are living now, we inhabit a political, social, and economic system that is in many respects founded on and sustained on a system of white supremacy.
No, I
right.
This is not aberration. This is the norm. Remember last week, a large group of white men armed to the teeth showed up in the Wisconsin state capitol and were threatening Michigan. Thank you. Michigan, Wisconsin.
No, I think it was Michigan.
Doesn't matter, right? They showed up in a state capitol.
Somewhere in the Midwest.
Armed to the teeth, threatening elected officials.
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Did you hear about the counter response? So Dean,
I did not.
So there was a black legislator that had to go into the Capitol where the day or two before all these white guys were armed with their M16s or whatever they're carrying, their AK-47s, who knows, whatever. But they're allowed to. This is legal. I just want everyone to know. It is not illegal. It's, you know what's ironic? You can't carry a sign into the Capitol, but you can carry, you know, an AK-47. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. Anyway,
America, man.
What happened was, I think he was a firefighter. And he was in this black legislator's district. He calls her up and says, I'm going to escort you into the building. And he gets a group of other folk, men of color and people of color, and they come with their weapons and they escort her into the building. All right? Because they're worried and concerned about her health and safety. Of course, even as this firefighter is doing this, he is appalled at the behavior of these guys from 2 days before. But he wants to sort of make a point by literally walking her in to protect her. And she's the one that has introduced legislation to make it illegal to carry firearms into the state capitol. I mean, Dean, this is a TV sitcom. This is, and this is real. And this is happening. And you just sit there and you look at it. The rest of the world must be just completely blown away. They already look at our president and think, oh my God, the level of madness coming out of Washington. But then you look at this story and the toxicity is literally flaming up everywhere. And I really blame Donald Trump as almost giving it a level of legitimacy. I mean, we've always known there are pockets of crazy. But now those pockets of crazy have their commander in chief basically mirroring their behavior.
Yeah, and you know, this is actually nothing new for the last couple of years. You can go back to Charlottesville. I mean, these kinds of this radicalization or more, you know, sort of open, more open protest and behavior and showing up in state capitals and guns and all that stuff, that's been kind of percolating to the surface really since President Trump ran for office. And so my reaction to our conversation thus far really is none of this is surprising. It's just kind of new examples of these fundamental issues that we've been dealing with now for 3 years. And then the other question is anything going to change?
Let me just say something. Yeah. And that is leadership matters. I hate to break it to you. Leadership matters.
Absolutely.
And if the leader is flaming it and encouraging it and throwing gas on it, it's going to make a difference. So, you know, yes, a lot of this has been going on, but there have been leaders that have tried to stop it or change it or address the conversation in a different way. And I think that leadership matters. And what we are seeing is...
Yeah, but not Trump.
All right, we need to go to a break. This is Rethink the Week, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will be back with Stephen Pimper and Dean Spiliotis. Stick around.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Missouri Botanical Garden has long been a trusted resource for information about plants and gardening. And now, local residents can turn to the garden to learn more about going solar.
One of the things that we hear the most from people is that, you know, I'm really interested in going solar at my home, but it's complicated and there's so many things for me to consider and I'm busy and I'll get to it one of these days.
That's Glenda Abney of the Botanical Garden Sustainability Division. Last year, the garden partnered with Washington University in St. Louis and the Midwest Renewable Energy Association on a program called Grow Solar St. Louis. The program offers information sessions designed to make it easy for local residents who are interested in installing solar at their homes.
At the end of the program, our solar providers are at the back of the room. You can go ahead and talk to them right then. Give them your address. They pull it up. They have a special software program, and they can tell you right then, with an initial review, if your home is viable.
In the first year, more than 70 participants installed solar panels, which exceeded expectations. So Abney says they plan to offer the program again. She says by encouraging clean energy, the garden is helping clean up the planet for plants and people. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Welcome back to Part 2 of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. And of course, this is our Rethink the Week. Joining us is Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He also has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. Joining us from UNH Manchester and the Carsey Institute, he is a fellow there, is Professor Stephen Pimper. He is an expert on poverty. Frankly, you're probably an expert on our lack of humanity when it comes to how we sort of treat people in this country. And what's happening with COVID-19 is just exacerbating every failure, every flaw. I feel like every scab is being pulled off and everything is oozing out. But it is now oozing out at a level that is even perhaps more shocking, but not surprising. I'm going to go to an article from the Daily Beast, gentlemen. The title, "The Justice Department is Now as Corrupt as the President." All right, that's the opening title. Just after the prosecutor assigned to the case resigned on Thursday, the Department of Justice announced that it dropped the charges against Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor who'd already pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russia. Of course, President Trump forecasted this before it happened. Last week, he insisted that Flynn had been exonerated, apparently referring to his pardon power. He hadn't pardoned him yet. Trump suggested that if the court did not do something, he would use a different kind of power. And now, Stephen Pimper, we know that it's happened. We know what the different kind of power is. He didn't have to pardon him. All he had to do was have his attorney general drop the charges. Oh my God. I mean, did anyone know that Barr was like this? I guess we don't have.
Yes.
But
this is perfectly predictable behavior from Barr. Remember, Barr was the one who set the wheels in motion for the pardons in the wake of the Iran-Contra affair, right? Yeah. Which lest we forget, right, was the most egregious abuse of executive power and efforts to circumvent legitimate authority of Congress, arguably since Watergate itself, right? This was not a trivial event. So this is absolutely who William Barr is. William Barr would not have gotten the job if he were not who he is.
But as the Daily Beast has noted and everybody else on the planet has noted, in fact, I believe President Obama had an interesting call with, 3,000 of his closest friends, where he was just totally shocked about what was happening to the rule of law. And while the Daily Beast says it is extremely unusual for the government to dismiss charges after a guilty plea, I think they've actually never found that. I think it's not even that it's unusual, Dean Spiliotis. It may be a case of first impression to do this. And then, of course, what they go on to say is, this is a sign that the historic independence of the Justice Department has been compromised. But of course, it was compromised from the moment that the president basically made him his attorney general, because we understood that it was his attorney general, not the attorney general of the United States, Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, Stephen's point about Barr and Iran-Contra is well taken, but my recollection of when he was appointed by Trump, that a lot of the kind of A-level pundits in Washington all said that this guy was going to come in and be a institutionalist and a guardrail on the president. And for those of us who are not attorneys, who don't follow the Justice Department quite as closely, it turned out to be a bit of a surprise, I think. Clearly he's part of the larger project, and this may be something he brought to the table on his own, and just a lot of people weren't aware of it. Part of this is sort of attack on the deep state, dismantling the entire Mueller report experience brick by brick, casting aspersions on the Obama Justice Department, Eric Holder, Loretta Lynch, et cetera. It really is this amazing kind of pitched battle to kind of take down those aspects of the legal bureaucracy that they believe are in some way have treated them unfairly.
And you know, a lot of this is in service to a broader project that Barr has been a part of, and that is sort of theories of unitary executive, right? The notion that as conceived by
wrote
the Constitution, exactly, that Article 2 conveys powers on the president that no historian or political scientist would agree with, right? But there's this incredibly aggressive notion of executive power, and we can see the ways in which all of this serves that larger project in a way that is particularly troubling and particularly threatening when you've got someone like Donald Trump, who has no concern, right, for law, for rules, for norms, for appropriate behavior, for equity, right? It's about, I mean, I don't know whether it's about power. I don't know whether it's about the grift. I don't know whether it's about ego. I don't pretend to know what's at the heart of it, but this is sort of an extraordinarily dangerous, though incremental, effort again to limit the ability of any other institution to check the ability of the executive branch to do what it wants.
I agree with you both completely, but I would take it one step further and say it's not just giving the president unchecked powers, but it is really an authoritarian, autocratic move against a democratic government at all. You know, the image, thank you, Stephen, for raising the Iran-Contra thing. But as soon as you said that, the image that raises in my mind is Oliver North standing in the White House, shredding all of the evidence, all of the documents that are there to prove the connection between the White House and the illegal activity in Iran and with the Contras. That is the epitome. And now what they're doing is they're basically taking apart the legal system, you know, the rule of law, and saying the law doesn't apply to me and my friends. And anybody that says anything to the contrary, the law will arrest them.
This is why the ongoing firing of the inspectors general is so troubling to
us. Of course.
Pay attention to this, right?
Right. Well, because a whistleblower is not a whistleblower. A whistleblower should be thrown in jail. I mean, what is he? I mean, it's amazing the language that Donald Trump. So as I'm looking at, you know, what's happening with COVID-19, I'm looking at the Trump administration, I'm looking at Bill Barr, and I'm thinking, okay, never has an election mattered to such a level as what we are seeing, Dean, going into 2020. And there are so many impediments to having an election where the results can be trusted. There are so many impediments to basically what the Democratic nominee is going to be able to say from his basement. So one of the reasons why Barack Obama had this, you know, this conference call with 3,000 people wasn't just he was outraged about what with Flynn and Barr, it's that he's really concerned about motivating people to understand how important it is for them to get out, for them to organize, for them to support their nominee, who doesn't necessarily excite people, Dean Spiliotis. I mean, let's be honest here. They're writing memos about how he needs to punch up out of the basement and he needs to use more social media. So let me just say something, Dean. I get it. He's being safe in the basement with his family, looking old, hanging out with his wife. I get that. But it isn't that he needs to use social media. What happened to the campaign around him? The way you do social media, Dean, isn't that he's sitting there tweeting and putting stuff out and putting out, you know, social media, Facebook ads. It's your team is doing this. Does he not have a freaking team? I'm just trying to figure out what is the level of confidence around him. And if Obama is so worried and Jim Clyburn resurrected this campaign that was just completely cratering, then they have an obligation for him to have a team because they better put it together, because it's obvious he didn't have the capacity up until they resurrected this campaign to have a campaign that really sort of made connections with voters. But now that he is basically our nominee, what the hell are people doing? And if you're waiting for him, I think that's the wrong plan. You better figure it out now.
Yeah, a couple reactions. I have read some reporting in the last the last couple of days that they're going to double the size of their digital media outfit over the next few weeks, because they realize the likelihood that he's going to be doing large rallies, or that they'll even have a convention, you know, a packed convention with all the appropriate visuals, is pretty unlikely. So they are significantly ramping up their digital operation. You know, the gap has kind of been filled by these independent advocacy groups like the Lincoln Project, and there's another one, another group that started to run ads against
Oh, great. Trump. And you know what? This is wonderful, Dean. Wait a second. I love it. So now we have Bill Clinton, who is the new Democrat, who made the Democratic Party feel more like the moderate Republicans. Now we've got the Lincoln Project, the people that are so appalled at Donald Trump, doing the ads for the Democratic Party. Why don't we just give it to, like, the Republicans? I mean, well, you know, when it used to be the Republicans, they should just take over the party, because apparently we are incapable of figuring it out. And I hate to break you. Then I had to wait for David Axelrod and Pluff to write a piece in the New York Times to say, hey, Joe, this is what you should be doing. They could have called me a month and a half ago, and I wouldn't even have to write it in the New York Times. I could have just sent them a tweet.
Well, then you'll really like this, Arnie. I also read some reporting that they're starting to ramp up their outreach to moderate Republicans and independents. So you're going to appreciate that. I will say, you know, with Obama, I think there was a clear, I mean, like you said, it was a private call for 3,000 people. So they were pretty sure it was going to leak out. And I think they knew that it would break
through. That
was
the plan.
They knew, they're up until Trump, there had been this kind of convention that you don't criticize other presidents. But, you know, Trump has kind of blown that to pieces at this point, because he's basically attacked every living president and a few that are no longer with us.
Abraham Lincoln, Washington, come on.
Yeah, so I think they knew that Obama going after him in a fairly public way would kind of break through the noise and maybe change the narrative a little bit. But I mean, it sounds like, again, I'm just going by what the reporting I'm reading. It sounds like the Biden folks are making some moves. I don't know that it's the moves that you would particularly want to see them make, but nonetheless, that's what they're doing.
Well, but the reason why, the fact that they're going after the independents and the moderate Republicans, Stephen, let me just make sure I remember reading this. The country is changing. It is browning. It is turning more black and Hispanic. It is looking at becoming a different country. So what are you doing? You're going back to old white guys who feel abandoned because of Donald Trump, who basically want to continue to massage, you know, the bankers and the military industrial complex, and they don't really care about climate change. Yeah, we can do a little bit to clean the air, but this is who he wants to court. As we're seeing people being exposed to incredible inequality, realizing they never again want to have to worry about work and health insurance being tied together because they might lose their job another 10 times in the future, and God forbid they lose their health insurance. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I'm looking for new blood, I'm not courting disgruntled Republicans, of which there may be 5 or 7%. I am looking at going into Native American tribal unit communities. I'm looking at going into New Mexico. I'm looking at going into Louisiana and saying, okay, you got screwed. We're going to fix it together.
You know, and of course, if you're looking to build a party to recognize that future, you're of course not nominating Joe Biden in the first place. But you know, I mean, I think this is sort of genuinely complicated, right? On the one hand, right, you've got the old adage, don't ever get in the way when your enemy is destroying himself, right?
Yes, I agree.
So on the one hand, I think maybe not a bad idea that Joe Biden, who is not particularly energetic or effervescent or appealing to particularly younger voters, right? Keep him in the basement, let Trump be Trump. And, you know, as the economy craters and the bodies pile up, traditionally that is going to have profound effects on the election. On the other hand, one of the things that I feel as if, I don't know, I feel that I've learned is that a lot of the things that I learned in graduate school, I am uncertain as to how many of those things hold true, not just in the Trump era, but in an era of these sort of hyper-polarized parties, sort of how many of those old historical patterns actually give us good guidance about what to expect for the future, right? But all that having been said, historically what works most effective means of both persuasion and getting out the vote is showing up at people's doors and knocking on them and talking to them. It's that one-on-one engagement with voters that can maybe motivate less interested voters to show up and maybe vote for your person. That's not an option. And I think that's probably unlikely to be an option this cycle because we're not doing all the things we need to do in order to make that possible, intentionally or not. So then what does that mean, right? So what is then the electoral strategy in this utterly unique moment for which we don't really have an historical analog? Right. What does a campaign look like? And I'm sure that I hope like hell there are people who actually run campaigns who are thinking deeply about that question, but I don't know that I've got an answer to it.
Well, and so I'm worried. I did actually, today is Sunday, the day that we taped the show. So at 6 o'clock tonight, if you turn on WGBH, and this is on Sunday night, you will hear me talking about voting. And so not only are we in a situation, Dean Spiliotis, where the political landscape is so complicated, there are no rallies, we can't have a traditional anything. We have a candidate who is not exactly effervescent, who is going to be sort of operating out of his basement. We've got a situation where we've got this absolutely toxic guy who will do anything to win. There are no rules. There is no rule of law. There isn't. And we have a voting situation now where we saw, for example, in Wisconsin, what happened. We're talking about whether we can actually have across the board mail-in voting, even as Donald Trump wants to make sure there will be no postal service. You can't do a mail-in voting if there's no postal service. And so I'm looking at all the challenges. It's not just mirroring Donald Trump and letting Donald Trump take himself down by himself, but it's making sure that people can exercise the franchise so that it's not just that there's a vote, but Dean, it can't be close. It can't be close. That's what scares me about this, is that that is just not acceptable given what he has done with the race war and the inequality war and the pandemic and the economy and everything else. We are so brittle and on such an edge. And now the challenge to vote is making it even more difficult to send the message you want to send. That yeah. If the vote is close, oh my God, it is a never ending fight because I fear he never leaves.
Yeah, we'll end up back in court. And it'll make 2000 look like a fairly routine decision. I really do, and I've said this a number of times, and I've talked about it with my students during the semester. This issue of ballot access is going to be the central front in the battle over exercising your right to vote. You can already see it shaping up. You know, Trump has been railing nonstop about the ability to vote by mail, how that's fraudulent. He will cast as much as he can the electoral apparatus into doubt, just in case he loses. If he doesn't lose, then it's all fine. Everything went smoothly. But he's got to have that kind of ace in the hole ready to go.
Exactly.
If he loses, he's going to say that this is fraudulent and, you know, they'll probably go to court, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very concerning thing, I think, for people. It's going to be fought out at the state level. It's going to go back and forth between kind of state legislative and state regulatory politics and kind of federal court cases over civil rights. It has the potential to be a real problem. We know if people are fully given their right to vote, and if Democrats show up, there are just more of them than there are of Republicans. So you would expectation is that it would be a clear victory. But there's no guarantee of that given that we're going into an electoral environment in the fall. I think a lot of it's going to be digital. You know, what's the campaign going to look like? It's going to be Twitter. It's going to be Facebook. It's going to be Instagram. It's going to be cable television. It's going to be podcasts, viral videos. Maybe if the virus goes into remission for a month or two, we'll get some rallies, but you can't count on that.
No, you won't have. And so the thing that I talked about on WGBH was I talked about the idea that COVID-19 or the fear of getting ill depending on the state in which you land, could be perceived as a disability for the purposes of absentee balloting, Stephen. So let me give you a case of two states, both of which have Republican governors, but different environments. My Republican governor in the state of New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, is surrounded by all Democrats all the time. I mean, virtually there is Republicans control niente. He is the only standing Republican. So he has now had a come to Jesus moment. And even though he hates mail-in balloting, and even though he doesn't really want to expand absentee balloting, he has decided that for the purposes of the November election, the fear of contracting COVID is now an excuse or a disability for the purposes of getting an absentee ballot, okay? So you can claim the fear of getting it is now a disability. In the state of Texas, guess what? We have a Republican governor too. Ah, but this Republican governor is surrounded by all Republicans, all right? And I mean, he's got Dan Patrick, who wants old people to die because actually there should be a sacrifice for the economy, who cares about COVID-19, and they've got an indicted attorney general. So it's just an incredible space, New Hampshire. But in Texas, the fear of contracting COVID-19 is not a disability, right? So now we have two states, both of which have very strict absentee balloting, not mail-in, but absentee, which is kind of a version of mail-in. And yet in one state, COVID, the fear of getting it, is considered a disability. And in another state, the exact same disease with the same footprint as this pandemic is not perceived as a disability. Doesn't this scream lawsuit, lawsuit, lawsuit? Why should an accident of geography tell you whether you have a, quote, disability in one state, but the exact same situation is not interpreted as a disability in another state? So it isn't just that different states have different rules about voting, but now they have different interpretations of what is a disability. That seems pretty sketchy to me, Stephen Pinder.
That seems entirely consistent with the Constitution as we know it and the way in which it has functioned over time, right? And as someone who has done a little bit of work looking at variation in the Medicaid program from state to state to state, right? This is a long-standing reality, right? Your experience of government, your ability to feed your family, your ability to pay your rent, your ability to access healthcare or mental health care depends on any number of things, but arguably the thing that matters most is where you live. It is precisely that accident of geography that most defines the variation in Americans' experience of the state. So nothing unusual at all. This is perfectly consistent with what I would argue is a failed federalism system, but that's another argument.
Can I just say that using it to define it as another meaning of disability is really a big mistake, I think. Yes, it should be an exception to let you vote by mail. You shouldn't have to go to the polls when you fear getting COVID-19. But to say that it's a disability, you know, disability is a legal term of art.
Well, but they're doing that in New Hampshire because that's how you can do this without having to get a new act of the legislature.
But then the vote can be, they can be sued afterwards saying that this isn't really a disability. You can't, or you cannot have a state change the legal definition of disability.
But Dean, my understanding is that the reason why Sununu is doing this is that it's face saving. So he gets to still sort of maintain that he isn't expanding the absentee ballot, that he isn't embracing mail-in, which he's not, because remember, he's still a Republican. You know, he still has to go to Donald Trump and say, remember, again, I want to remind everyone who Chris Sununu is. Chris Sununu is the guy that in 2016 goes on a radio talk show in Massachusetts with Howie Carr, a conservative yahoo, and basically talks about all the illegal Massachusetts voters that are going to come across the New Hampshire border to vote illegally in order for Donald Trump to lose. I mean, remember, this is Chris. So, and that started this whole...
Well, and he was also doing an interview, I can't remember who it was with, where he said that after the original SB3 legislation that he was done and he wasn't going to push for any more. And then we end up with HB 1264, which is the residency substitution bill, swapping out domicile and swapping in these residency requirements. All of that stuff's in court now. So It seems like it's from a strategic perspective, it's a reasonable thing for him to do politically. But the big problem here that is always a shock to people is when they find out how much of this stuff is driven on a state-by-state basis. And that, New Hampshire versus Texas is a perfect example.
And yet what I think is so fascinating, and you saw this in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where they had 180 voting places and it dropped down to three. And the reason why wasn't that people wanted to make it difficult for people to vote. It's that none of the volunteers wanted to man the voting places because they didn't want to get COVID-19. And the people that man the voting locations are your elderly, your seniors, people with underlying conditions. That's your typical volunteer. It's some little old lady with blue hair who's sitting there going, oh, I just love to see Margaret because that's why I do it. And now they're going, I am not going to die in order for me to see my girlfriend come and vote. I mean, that's what this is. And when I was talking about this on WGBH, this is great. So apparently Charlie Baker, who is the Republican governor of Massachusetts, another Republican, moderate Republican, he understands the dilemma, but he still wants to have voting in place. He does not want to have mail-in voting in Massachusetts because I guess it flies in the face of his, you know, GOP DNA. But here's what he said to folks who are worried about whether they're going to be able to man up all their voting stations. And what he says is, not a problem. I'll send my people in to assist you. And I'm thinking, really? How many people do you have? I mean, how many voting stations are there? I mean, this is insane. And yet never has an election mattered so much, and never has trusting the results of an election mattered so much. And it is total chaos. And I'm being told I need to end this. Gentlemen, this is a wild Rethink the Week. Thank you, Stephen Pimpare. Thank you, Dean. Imagine next Monday. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Arnie. Take care.
Do you know what I did, you guys? So if you listen to WGBH, and they kept it in, I wasn't sure they were going to edit it out. So I'm like apoplectic about it's a disability here, but not a disability there, and whatever. And so I do the shout out. Are there any Harvard Law School graduates that are listening? Is there anyone from the Brennan Center listening? Don't you guys want to sue? I literally say this on WGBH. I'm like screaming into the ether.
It's going to be a lot of lawsuits.
Like, oh, yeah. Oh, my God. It's just amazing.
Well, that's why progressives should not agree with Sununu's. Arnie says he's saving face. Well, why do we care if
Sununu or Trump I don't care.
Save face. We shouldn't let him get away with defining it.
Is anybody challenging that? Do you know?
I don't know yet.
Not legally
I think
yet.
That might be happening. And let me just share one other thing I didn't share with you guys, but I did share on WGBH. So I cover Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. So I have to look at this story going on all over New England. So what's happening in Vermont? Now, Scott is even more moderate than Sununu, about the same as Charlie Baker. But they're going to have a regular primary because the primaries in Vermont are so tiny that, you know, nobody votes anyway, and they figured they could, you know, hermetically seal everyone that shows up to vote. But the general election will be a different story. So the Secretary of State, who's a Democrat, wants to do mail-in voting. And Scott, here's his answer. Well, I don't know. Let's wait till the primary in August, and then we can decide. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. What's to wait for? You know that Fauci is talking about it's going to be worse in the fall. We're going to have two kinds of flu. It's November. What do you need to know now that you won't know in August? In addition to which, if you're going to do absentee, you're going to do mail-in voting across the board, they have to order. They have to get the ballots out. I mean, there's so much work to be done that the mañana, you know, if you listen to it quickly, sounds reasonable. When you'll just spend 30 seconds, it's so unreasonable for him to say, let's wait. That's not an answer either, Dean.
Well, especially since, as Dean said, you wait until fall, and a lot of lawsuits take time.
Yeah, take time, right.
Get to Labor Day, and it's too late to file.
I know. It's just incredible. Anyway, thank you so much, gentlemen.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks, Arnie.
That was fun. All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. Folks.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye, all.
All right, take care.